Welcome to Resounds, Arts and Culture on the High Plains. I'm Corby Skinner.
And I'm Anna Page. And we're sharing stories of creative people who live and work in the Intermountain West.
Writers Bernie Quetschenbach and Kara Chamberlain didn't set out to release books at the same time. It just happened that way.
They're authors of two new books released this spring, as well as Husband and Wife. Kara's is a book of poetry titled Lament of the Antichrist in a Secular World and Other Poems.
Wow, that's not only a mouthful, it's one heck of a title for a book. And it certainly begs further investigation.
Agreed. Bernie's is a collection of essays titled Accidental Gravity, Residents, Travelers, and the Landscape of Memory.
Bernie is a professor of English at Montana State University, Billings. He's the author of The Hermit's Place, a collection of poetry, and his work has appeared in a variety of anthologies and journals.
And Kara is the author of two previous books of poetry, Hidden Things and The Divine Botany. Her work has appeared in such journals as the Southern Review, Boston Review, and Tar River Poetry.
Both writers reside in Billings.
Today in the studio, we have two authors with us who have just released new books, Kara Chamberlain and Bernie Quetschenbach. I'm glad I was able to get your last name out, Bernie. Was it sufficient? Okay, we're getting a nod, yes, so yeah. We're good to go. All right, so Kara's new book is a collection of poetry called Lament of the Antichrist in a Secular World. Gotta say, that's one of my favorite titles so far I've heard.
Thank you.
And Bernie is a collection of essays that is being dubbed as nature writing, Accidental Gravity, Residents, Travelers, and the Landscape of Memory, which really focuses a lot on Bernie's travels across the country. So it seems like you guys have been many places. We were talking before we hit record about where you met.
Yes.
And I think you forgot to mention they're married. This is a married couple of writers with new books.
Yeah, I do forget you guys have quite a literary household. In your books, in the acknowledgments of your books, Kara, you credit Bernie with saving you many embarrassments. And Bernie, you mention your gratitude to Kara for her patience and support for reading every word of this manuscript, including thousands that are no longer there. So it really made me wonder, what's your household like?
Just normal household.
Yeah. Except for all those words that we've gotten rid of that are floating around.
I was going to say, there must be thousands of words hanging around.
I thought it was dog hair, but maybe it's words.
So you guys came together early on. How did you meet?
We met in Lake Charles, Louisiana, and we were both ready to go to graduate school. And we saw posters saying, come study in our tropical paradise with jazz music, exotic water birds, and French cuisine.
Oh, it was also a picture of Leda and the swan.
Right.
So it looked nice, you know.
Yeah. And it was actually a refinery town like 30 miles from the Texas border. And the French cuisine was Boudin sausage and, you know, things like that. But
the marketing was well put together. Yeah, right. Okay. So that brought you together. And sounds like you're both good support systems for one another as you write.
I think so. I mean, we have to give each other space. So. Yeah. I don't see what he's working on until he's ready, and he doesn't see what I'm working on until I'm ready.
And how did you put out books at the same time? It sounds like maybe you just lived separate lives for a while until you came together for the editing process.
It was just luck, I think.
Yeah. Coincidence. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Bernie, your book really sort of chronicles all these moves that you've made and kind of looks at the beginning of like mid-century American suburbia, sort of where you were in New York, and then is about this intersection of place and memory. So you take Lake Ontario and Yellowstone as these twin natural centers of your universe. How did you concept bringing these two things together to write this collection of essays?
Well, I had written the essays first, and I knew that I knew I was writing a collection of essays, but what I didn't know is that you had to like make it a solid thing and not just a collection of essays. And so I was kind of looking for an organizing principle. The original title was Origins and Distances. So that was going to be the kind of theme. And that was the working title. So that's kind of where it all sort of fell in. And then I looked for, well, I could put this one here and put a kind of parallel one in the, you know, and I sort of built the structure really after the fact.
Because you say the Great Lake and the Great Park or where you best remember who you are. So you're very tied to place and memory throughout this book.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. Yeah.
Bernie, essays are an interesting thing because you have to be a very good writer to do an essay. But in terms of publishing a book, don't you have to have a concept? I mean, did you need that concept to sell it to the publisher?
Yes. In fact, that's what I discovered. It needed some sort of shaping kind of structure to it. Yeah, because they're very concerned. Publishers are very shy of essay collections, which strikes me as funny because people read essays all the time in magazines and you know, and suddenly you have a collection of essays and publishers are like, ooh, I've never seen one of these before, you know, but you really have, you know, but yeah.
I found that the language of Accidental Gravity is part poetic, part introspective, but in fullness, it's just really very lyrical almost in composition. There's this contrast between, you know, the sprawling man-made environment and the natural one that came before, and you do a great job of bringing in sounds of neighborhoods and of local culture. In one of the early essays in the book, there's this falcon navigating the same route as the commuter. I like the juxtaposition that you have throughout.
That was one of the things that I was trying to do. And if you look at the cover, that city skyline actually is Rochester. So it's kind of like almost like a bad upstate New York pun with Rochester and Buffalo. But the buffalo, of course, are actually bison. But so I did want to get that sense of the natural and the man-made kind of playing off of each other. And all landscapes are humanized in a way, right? And all human areas are natural in a way. And so I wanted to kind of demonstrate that and how it works in my own life.
And you also reference place-based writers. Obviously, Thoreau comes to mind. Mm-hmm. So did you read a lot of that sort of essay to sort of piece together Accidental Gravity?
I've read a lot of that kind of essay before, and my take was, well, what happens if you're not Wendell Berry and you don't have a family farm? What happens if you grew up like most of us did in you know, kind of faceless suburban areas, or so we thought until we really got to kind of think about them? So I was more interested in expanding kind of the way in which one looks at one's life from that base of having the generations-long commitment to a place, which I think a lot of us grew up in the time when I grew up didn't really have access to that. We moved around, we followed our careers, we followed whatever we followed, right? You know, and that's where I get the concept of accidental gravity is whatever it is that we're following, basically, that leads us from place to place and life to life.
Yeah, it's an incredible collection of place-based knowledge. Were you collecting data for this book, or did it come to you just in a specific way?
Well, I research things that I'm writing about. When I was editing it over the summer, it's a funny thing that you mentioned that, because I had to make a lot of corrections of things that I thought were true that weren't, basically, or like the, you know, I had a map in my head that wasn't quite right, or there was something that needed to be adjusted. So memory can be kind of treacherous in that regard as well.
I was really struck by the way you sandwich climate change with, like, let's say, the music of your youth. Can I share this passage from one of the chapters?
Sure.
Summertime. Summertime, long, hot, but not so very hot, days by the lake shore. The water not clean, but better than it was, sure, and always cool. Black terns skim the shore. Offsprays will return with DDT banned. So much time. Out of school, lying back with the transistor radio, BBF tossing out day tripper, and the kids are all right, along with harmless fluff like incense and peppermints. As lampreys sail in on the St. Lawrence Seaway, waterfront houses pop up faster than cattails around Long Pond. The war in Vietnam inches across the years toward my 18th birthday. But for now, sings Janice, the living is easy. I just love the way you were able to bring in these references to these songs that we all know so well and pop up those cattails and see these birds moving about in ways that I'd not heard sandwiched together before.
Well, that's kind of the way it is in the real world, right? Everything is sort of sandwiched together, and, you know. And that was one of the things that I was trying to work on. There's not... In people's real lives, you don't have nature over here and culture over here, right? I mean, they're all sort of scrambled together. And so and they should be scrambled together, right? So we have this sense that we're all very compartmentalized, and that when we're doing this, we can't be doing that, or if we're enjoying music, we can't be looking at birds. You know, why not? You know, why can't it all be sort of combined into the experience of an actual numinous sort of environment that we live in?
Yeah, it intersects all the time, and often you're right. We do view it compartmentalized, even though it's very much an integrated part of us. And I love how you follow up that passage with a quote from Robert Frost: "Returning to the source offers a chance to be whole again beyond confusion, but you acknowledge that it can never be the same." So it almost seems like this shifting landscape of progress comes at the expense of the environment.
Yeah, and I think probably it was to some extent true even when Robert Frost was saying it, that, you know, you try to go back to some base, and the base itself is shifting, but it's shifting so fast now that we can really see it shift, or we can sense it shift in a way that we didn't sense it before, maybe.
Yeah, and there's an acceptance in accidental gravity that all of these things are as they are going to be.
Kara, I'm very familiar with your first two books of poetry that were quite lyrical, nature-based. And then here we have The Lament of the Antichrist in a Secular World. That is a big leap. And I know you. I don't sense that you're a religious person. How did the nature of this book come about?
Well, actually, I had a teenage religious crisis, and like maybe a lot of people, didn't know whether to follow an organized religion, what to do with myself and these beliefs, which were, because perhaps of adolescence, overwhelming. So I set about reading a lot of religious literature, including the Bible a few times, Tibetan Book of the Dead, the various texts from Buddhism that are available in translation. And I just became enamored eventually, once I recovered from the spiritual crisis, I became enamored of the language in the King James Version of the Bible and the stories. And I got to wondering about these characters that are sometimes where their stories are left hanging, or they're underrepresented, or they're presented in a way that's not friendly to them, but they're very interesting characters. So David and Saul, I always had a soft spot for Saul, even though David's the hero of the story, right? But, you know, Saul, he didn't want to be king, really, and he's in this horrible position, and he does what he can, and he's a normal human being, and David is God's chosen. So, you know, I identified a lot with Saul, I think, in that. But I don't find these poems to be divorced from nature. I mean, I think there's a lot of nature imagery. So it seems of a piece, I guess, with my other writing.
Well, what I find interesting is you're doing with your characters sort of the same thing that Bernie is doing with nature and city life. I mean, saying that those two things do not need to be separate. I mean, we live in both of those, and we can see them in the same way or experience them. So your characters are real people, not just mythical or biblical characters, true?
Yeah, I think, I mean, the Antichrist himself is kind of like a door-to-door salesman, you know, and he finds the no solicitors sign and doesn't know what to do. So it's very much a modern world, and I had some fun with the anachronisms, you know, throwing in something from our current world into that old time,
like,
you know,
Ezekiel amongst the mall walkers.
Yeah,
or
right.
Was it Nebuchadnezzar and trickle down economics?
Right.
Yeah, there's a lot of great modern familiarity that come with these historical characters. How did you come up with the ideas for these poems?
Boy, I don't know. They've been a long time in the making and gestating, and I've rearrange them and change them so much. I can't really remember the initial impetus, but I think it basically was, you know, walking through something, some very modern place like a mall, and thinking, oh, what would happen if Ezekiel was just sitting on that bench there? What would people think? They'd probably think he was a Middle Eastern terrorist. You know, would he be wearing robes? What would happen? He'd probably be hauled off by the police. So that made me think about how we would respond to these stories that inform our world so much, but we don't really think about them as being part of our lives in the same way the ordinary trappings of modern day existence are.
Yeah, it's wildly inventive. And as Corby said, too, there's a strong sense of place. I mean, you've got references to glaciered peaks and the plowed fields and vanishing farms and subdivisions and retail stores. They're all sort of sandwiched in here. So we have this historical context with a modern landscape. It's very fascinating. How did place play a role in these poems for you?
Place is always important. I always like a story with a setting. Well, there's a poem about a goat and the sheep and the goats, you know, sort of thing. And it was based on a real goat I saw in a Montana field. So I think the scenes are from my life, and I've put these characters in them. So it's the same thing as writing a poem from your own experience, but the experience is also literary experience.
Have people thought that the characters in these poems are sort of off limits to be thrown into the 20th century? Have you had reaction from some of the readers sort of concerned about using sort of sacred characters in a profane way?
I haven't, but I don't know how everyone feels. So, I mean, I had some trepidation too, because I know this is meaningful on many levels to many different people. And I don't want it to seem like it's a parody, or if it's as if it's making fun of religious belief. To me, it's actually making it more pertinent, because it's just an invitation to, well, think about what this person, what Jezebel would be like if you met her. You know, put yourself in these wonderful stories.
So a lot of the characters are actually archetypes for people in our own time. I'm thinking of one particularly, Nebuchadnezzar, and you have great fun with that, looking at who he was as a person and finding some parallels to contemporary times.
Yeah, well, that poem is about 10 so or so years old. So I was thinking about the political scene at that time, but I mean, it's your standard fable of somebody who gets too big for their britches. And God, in this case, says, oh, yeah, you know, you're going to go crawl around on your hands and knees and eat grass. Do you think you're my best pal? Well, you know, that doesn't happen with human beings, right? So it's kind of I'd like people to read into it whatever they want to, whatever, maybe somebody you know, maybe somebody you know of. It's just the course of human life, I think. We go up and then we get taken down.
And I would say that there's a fierceness and an anger in many of these poems. I think it's especially evident in some of the female characters. Did you find in a historical sense women to be repressed and maybe portrayed in an untrue way?
I don't know if it's so much untrue as that it's only part of the story. So we have Mrs. Lot. I call her Mrs. Lot because she doesn't get a first name in the Bible. And, you know, she's the woman who looks back because she's perhaps feeling superior to her neighbors, and she's turned into a pillar of salt. But really, is that how she felt? We don't know. We don't know much about her story. What was her relationship with her daughters? You know, what did she think about maybe having grandkids someday? And then she ends up as a pillar of salt. So I wanted to fill in the blanks, I think, of these lives a little bit, you know, as much as I could imagine that they might face.
And you've organized the book into seven sections. So, you know, one of the sections I'm thinking of is When She Was Bad. Of course, we know the rest of that rhyme. When she was good, she was very, very good. So when she was bad, she was horrid.
Yes.
The style of arrangement really helps the book progress, as opposed to maybe a chronological approach. It comes together as a whole. I feel like no one piece stands distinctly alone. How did this approach help you organize the poems in the book?
Actually, the organization of the poems was chronological at first, but that didn't work at all because they were so different. And, you know, and then it was Old Testament, New Testament, and the poems weren't talking to each other. So I rearranged them many, many times. It didn't help or hurt, actually, to write the poems or anything like that. But eventually I thought, well, I'll just put the Ezekiel poems together because they have a certain outlook. And then I'll put the prophets together and the bad girls and the good girls and, you know, that kind of thing. So it eventually made sense to do it that way.
Well, I have a question both for Bernie and Kara, because maybe I'm not reading correctly, because when I pick up a book of poetry or essays, I don't read front to back. I mean, I kind of thumb through the book. Sometimes I read a few short pieces, and then I see a longer piece if I have more time. Do you want people to read from the beginning to the end?
Yeah, I think I do. I mean, but I don't mind if people jump around either. I mean, hopefully, I'll do that in a bookstore. You just open the book and read a poem, and if you like it, then you might thumb a little farther and, you know, eventually decide you want to take the book home with you or not. So that's a perfectly fine way to read poetry, I think. But since I've been putting collections of poetry together and studying what other people do to put collections together, I think there is a method there that if you do read from front to back, you get a journey and it's meaningful. And you can certainly read without doing that, but I think it enhances the experience, at least from what I've read, most writers are very concerned about that.
Yeah, I was pretty concerned to make the book a complete thing in and of itself, even though the essays were first published in magazines, and at which point, of course, they wouldn't have the whole kind of structure of the book be behind them. To some extent, I was thinking just being practical. I wanted to put all of the ones from when I was a kid growing up in the beginning, and I wanted to put all the ones that were from when I live around here in the back. And then I was concerned about things like, I'm visiting my parents in this essay. I didn't want one where they were no longer alive before it, right? So I was worried on a very practical level. But I do think you can get a sense of going from here to there and having a beginning and an end, even if you're putting it together after the fact. And I did want to do that. But you can read them in whatever order you please. Don't expect too much logic if you go against the order.
I wanted to read this quote, Bernie, from your intro. It just struck me so beautifully and probably along the lines of everything we've been talking about. What we play is the music of circumstance, a ragged, delicate hymn, the soul song of our shared and lonely lives. Kara, would you like to share any of the poems from your work?
I'll read The Dogs Eat Jezebel. And there's a little passage that starts you off in this poem. In case you don't quite remember Jezebel, she's the terrible wife of the terrible King Ahab. And this is from 2 Kings 9:35. When they went to bury her, they found no more of her than the skull and the feet and the palms of her hands. The dogs eat Jezebel. She scorned that old fool Ahab, taken to wandering, if you want to know, in his bedroom slippers and sackcloth. I repent of my sins, he wailed. But she, by herself, would kill 500 more prophets if she could. Those hairless, puling vagrants after the new mode, following Elijah, their own idol. She tore a pomegranate with her teeth, still sharp and whole after all these years, and aimed the seeds at Baal. They spilled down his paunch like ruby teats. Prophets of the single god, she spat more seed, carried disaster and whips as they shed maggots throughout the golden fields where Ashtoreth lazed in her sultry fat or rolled like a sigh of butterflies. The queen was screaming, wild as possible, as they sewed her on the dogs she'd trained. Lewd palms of her hands shriveled and fell like rabbit teeth given to a harvest that swallowed them, while earth, once hearty, turned a chaste shoulder, prophets of the Lord and sons of prophets trudging and thrilled by meager fruit.
I love the reference to pomegranate in there. Was it a Persephone who was trapped in the underworld for eating the pomegranate?
Yes, she ate 7 pomegranate seeds, I think. Was stuck.
The penance for eating the sweet fruit. Thank you.
That's right.
We have time for one more. Is there another one that you would like to share?
I'll do a short one. This is about Isaiah, and there's no particular Bible verse, although the title comes from Isaiah 59, verse 17. Garments of vengeance, mantle of fury. I've plunged uphill in clouds, in rain. I've slept naked in summer on my favorite bed, sand beneath a juniper, stars cream above. Each house below smolders with the common sense of lamps. A mother chooses an innocent nightie, then adds her lace seduction. I ought to censure them again. And what's the use? I'll be alone tonight. I'll be gentle. I can give up, let it go. The infinite stars won't care.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for being here and sharing.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, you can pick up Kara Chamberlain's book, Lament of the Antichrist in a Secular World and Other Poems. If you're in Billings, I know it's at this House of Books. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, people can order online?
Yes, they can. It's on Amazon and Barnes & Noble.
All right. And Bernie, your book?
Is also at this House of Books and Barnes & Noble, and it can be ordered through Oregon State University Press or through Amazon.
You've been listening to Resounds, Arts and Culture on the High Plains, produced by Anna Page, Corby Skinner, and Ken Siebert for Yellowstone Public Radio. Theme music by Alex Naumann. Hear this program anytime online at ypradio.org.